Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It's great to speak with you again. I hope you're doing well. My name is Henrik Palmgren, a native of Sweden, Götaland, the land of the Goths, in fact, to be precise, the once home to the beautiful Norse temple that was burnt almost 1,000 years ago, speculated in and around 1080. It is indeed time for this essence to rise once again. Our website is redicecreations.com. This is an independent radio program that touch upon many subjects that interests us. We hope they will interest you as well. We consider some of them to be the most important issues at this time. And this then includes the importance of viewing history in the proper context so that we may understand the present. Our guest today is Joshua Blakeney, a freelance journalist based in Calgary, Alberta, in Canada, who was born 4.5 miles from where the Magna Carta was signed in Surrey in the UK. He has been Press TV's Canadian correspondent since April 2012. His writings have been published in an array of internationally reputed media venues, including Global Research, Rabble, Pravda, Voltaire Net, Cold Type, the Canadian Dimension, the Canadian Charter, Veterans Today, the Sovereign Independent, and the Information Clearinghouse. He is the co-host of The Real Deal radio show and co-founder of Non-Aligned Media. Well, our program today is going to be about his new book called Japan Strikes Back. Very interesting show ahead. Welcome, Joshua. Thank you so much for coming on the program. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me on, Henrik. It's a great privilege to appear on Red Ice Radio. Thanks so much.
Very good. Thank you. I appreciate that. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you ended up writing Japan Bites Back here before we get into detail and the meat of the book. Very few, especially I'd say in the West, actually take an interest in any of the so-called Axis sides of World War II, and they're kind of stuck in the post-war propaganda by the Allies, and to a certain extent, we are all kind of victims of the post-war reconstructions of our societies. But how did you break out of that, Joshua, and how did you end up writing the book?
Yeah, so in 2010, I embarked upon graduate studies at the University of Lethbridge here in Alberta, Canada, about 9/11. And I actually started getting demonized by Zionists in the media here in Canada. They were contacting my university. A former Mossad agent named Michael Ross began calling the dean of my graduate school saying, "What's going on? You're giving quote-unquote taxpayer money, funding a young academic to study quote-unquote conspiracy theories." And when you get assailed in the Zionist press, obviously you make a lot of friends. And one friend I made was Press TV, the English language media outlet based in Tehran. And so I've been appearing on Press TV now. I've probably done more than 100 appearances live on Press TV, and I've done, submitted reports to Press TV. I've been Press TV's Canadian correspondent. And so I've been involved in basically attempting to analyze the demonization of Iran contemporarily. Often the neocons and the Zionists, they liken Iran to the Nazis and to National Socialist Germany. And maybe there are some certain parallels to be made between Iran and National Socialist Germany in terms of who they locked horns with, etc. But, I've actually, another sort of current in my life has been, I've been visiting Japan since I was 19 and I took Japanese classes at university. I'm not too bad at speaking Japanese for a guy from London, England. I began to realize as I got into the historiography of Japan, and especially of Imperial Japan and of the Pan-Asianists, that analogies between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Japan were actually more fitting and more apposite. And obviously all historical analogies are sort of to some extent flawed. They're never perfect. But I began to realize as I got more and more into the subject of Japan and revisionistic interpretations of Japan in the World War II, that there were some parallels to be made. So I thought it would be fruitful for me to actually specialize in this issue. Once you get into 9/11, you begin to ask, well, what are all the other subjects we've been lied about? Lied to about. And so I don't speak German. I haven't been to Germany for many years, but I do go to Japan. I do speak some Japanese. And so I thought I'd get into this if I was going to contribute to the very important field of World War II revisionism. And I began to research initially the Western journalists who were pro-Japan, you might call them my equivalents in the sense that I'm ensconced in the West, but I think that Iran is, many of their stances, geopolitical stances, are more defensible than those of the Western powers. And those of us who have been trying to de-demonize Iran, well, there were those in the war contemporaneously who sought to de-demonize Japan. And in the US, many journalists were rounded up on the orders of FDR. One was Ralph Townsend. Another was David Warren Ryder. And literally, they were just journalists in America who started saying, "What? It's crazy for America to be ostracizing Japan and siding with warlords in China who are destabilizing China. We think it's economically and geopolitically rational for America to side with Japan as the main bulwark of anti-communism in that region." Ralph Townsend was in a particularly strong position to be opining on these subjects because he'd actually worked in U.S. consulates in Shanghai and in Tokyo. And so he was au fait with the facts on the ground in those respective jurisdictions. And so he began writing articles saying, you know, giving his explanation as to why the interpretation of China as this sort of underdog fighting for a republic and for democracy being besieged by Japanese monarchical imperialist forces, yeah, akin to King George III's redcoats, was actually erroneous. And he was self-publishing pamphlets, and he sold some pamphlets to a Japanese entity, and he was incarcerated for doing so in the war. And so I began looking up his articles, and I realized that really none of his writings were available online. And so I began collating his publications. So I began calling antique bookstores throughout America and in Europe and tracking down his writings. And there was one elusive article published in a periodical called Contemporary Japan, a review of Far Eastern affairs, which was published by the Foreign Affairs Association of Japan. And this was sort of Japan's Press TV or Japan's Russia Today, their attempt to reach out to the English-speaking world and to provide a pro-Japanese interpretation of geopolitical happenings at the time. And so as I began tracking down this one elusive article, I began buying copies of Contemporary Japan, and I began becoming aware of the work of the Foreign Affairs Association of Japan. And so I have sort of slowly but surely collated an archive here in my house of all these publications that were published in the 1930s. And, you know, often the pages are stuck together and they're tattery and they kind of smell and they're molding. And, you know, I've got all these old documents here now. Cool. And I began perusing the work of David Warren Ryder, too. He was another journalist who, on the personal order of FDR, was incarcerated in the war. And I called one antique book dealer in the States, and he said, I know David Warren Ryder's daughter, and she was in my bookstore yesterday, and she's actually given me all his papers, and I'll sell them to you for a pittance. So I also bought up his publications. So I decided to go to the National Diet Library in Tokyo, realizing as I did that many of the English language publications of the Foreign Affairs Association of Japan are contained in their archives. In September of 1945, just 1 month after the U.S. had incinerated approximately 250,000 people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And of course, we're commemorating the anniversary of the firebombing of Tokyo right now, the 70th anniversary. Yep. The U.S. killed 100,000 women and children in one day on March 9th, 1945. Wow. And that's the 70th anniversary just passed of that. But anyway, so in September of 1945, the newly installed GHQ established a civil censorship detachment, and they were commissioned, the members of that detachment were commissioned to go out into Japan and to immediately seize any publications which either provided a favorable interpretation of the Japanese decisions in that epoch or disfavorably interpreted U.S. and Western imperial intrigue in that region contemporaneously. And so they slated 7,769 publications to be literally book burned. There's a Japanese think tank called the Society for the Dissemination of Historical Fact, and they publish many of their essays in English, fortunately. These are Japanese revisionists, because revisionism in Japan is far less taboo and is far more mainstream than it is in other countries in the world.
Interesting.
It's interesting that only really in Tokyo and Tehran these days you don't get thrown into a dungeon for questioning the official history of World War II.
Yeah.
And so there's a scholar named Nishio Kanji, and he's got a publication on there called Breaking the Seal on the GHQ's book burning, which people can look up. And he refers to this as book burning, that 7,769 publications were identified. But the quid pro quo was that the Americans pressured the then Imperial Library, which morphed into the Japanese, the National Diet Library today in Tokyo, which I visited. They pressured them to basically help them identify the relevant documents to be book burned. And the quid pro quo was that they got to keep many of those documents for posterity in their archives. So I went to the National Diet Library and I walked in. It's next to the Japanese Parliament, walked past the Fukushima protesters and all the other protesters outside the Japanese Parliament who are there all the time. And I went into the National Diet Library in September of 2014. And I walked in, I registered, got my ID card, and I spent days there going through the archives and pulling out documents. So I pulled out 28 documents. And so those documents combined with, or some of those documents combined with other documents I procured here in North America, constitute my new book, which is entitled Japan Bites Back, Documents Contextualizing Pearl Harbor. And listeners of Red Ice Radio can visit my website or the website of Brandon Martinez and myself, which is nonalignedmedia.com, for an elaboration or an enlargement upon the particulars of my book.
All right, very good. We're going to talk a little bit more about this. There's a lot of different interesting little factors to this story that make it up here, but maybe we can talk a little bit first about the about Japan as the aggressor, then, that they were never in, you know, kind of on a mission of world conquest and things like this. They teamed up with Germany, and it, still to this day, that's a factor that's kind of very much unknown of why that happened. But maybe we can talk about the backdrop there a little bit and how Japan perceived the threat of communism. What do you know about that?
Yes. So I've often said that Iran's 1979 was Japan's 1868. And so in the middle of the 19th century, in the 1850s, Commodore Perry, whose daughter was married to a Rothschild, actually, or married to someone who worked for the Rothschilds. I've discussed this with James Perloff. Huh. Commodore Perry barged into Japanese society. Japan had been extremely isolated for centuries. Any foreigner who turned up there, with the exception of a few Dutch who were able to operate in Nagasaki, any foreigners who turned up there otherwise were executed on the spot, and Christianity was illegal. And as such, Japan had developed very uniquely, like racially, you know, they'd become homogenized into a unique descent group, culturally, actuarially, ideologically. They'd formed in a, they'd managed to develop in an autonomous way. And that was shattered when Commodore Perry barged into Japan on behalf of the U.S. government in the 1850s and imposed a series of unequal treaties upon Japan. And so in 1868, after some civil war took place, there was the Meiji Restoration. And they realized that, you know, whether we like it or not, we're going to have to send our minions out to Oxford University and to Harvard University and to the West to learn Western science and Western methods in order to develop and in order to inoculate ourselves from the increasing threat in Asia. You know, people will have heard of the Opium Wars and of all these other examples of Western imperial intrigue in the region. And the Japanese, you know, if you look at the IQ studies, they have the highest mean IQ out of any descent group in the world. They're very intelligent people. And as such, they realized that they were going to have to enter modernity and to westernize. And so what happens when you start industrializing? Well, your population bourgeons, your population begins to expect a higher standard of living. And so their development sort of created a whole host of other problems. Also, they obviously were able to develop militarily. And then, you know, the ears of the West began to prick up and they realized that Japan wasn't going to necessarily just be quiescent. And in fact, it was beginning to emerge as a regional hegemon. And the Japanese government took the point of view that we can't just sit here like lame ducks and wait for the West to spread throughout Asia. And then we'll just be the final domino to knock down in Asia, that we have interests on the mainland of Asia. And in 1904, 1905, the Russo-Japanese War took place. There was also a Sino-Japanese War at the end of the 19th century, which led to Japan's annexation of Korea. You know, the Japanese began to take the view basically that there's all these weak agrarian societies like the Korean Peninsula, and either Britain, the British Empire, or Russia, or the Germans, or other alien powers to the region are going to colonize those weak agrarian jurisdictions, or we are. And we have an organic Asiatic connection to this region.
Yeah.
We have a Confucian ideology that we share, a pan-Buddhist ideology that we share. And it's far more natural for us to go there and to help to build up Asia collectively among the Asian people. And so after the Russo-Japanese War in 1904-1905, Japan inherited Russia's rights in the region. And that irked the West even more. And the West came to Japan and actually forced them to relinquish many of those rights. And so this was sort of the backdrop to the tension that arose there. And within Japan, there was a lot of factionalism domestically in politics. Like there were some Japanese who wanted to work with the British Empire and work with Western powers and viewed themselves as, you know, the white men of Asia or whatever, the civilized people of Asia. But slowly a faction or a tendency of Pan-Asianists came along, and they began to say, look, this idea of collaborating with the West is delusional, is fanciful, and we have to take the initiative as the most developed nation in Asia and expel the white man from Asia. And the most prominent of those Pan-Asianist thinkers was Okawa Shume. He was put on trial at the Tokyo trials, and we can talk about the Tokyo trials later. I've gone through the transcripts of many of the transcripts of the Tokyo trials. 80% of the evidentiary submissions made by the Japanese defense at the Tokyo trials was rejected. And the scholars at the Society for the Dissemination of Historical Fact have actually republished those rejected submissions, which you can read on their website. But Okawa Shume emerged, and he'd been to India and seen what the British were doing in India. And he became a proponent of Pan-Asianism. And like they had this Pan-Asianist conference in Nagasaki in like 1926, and it was scorned in the Japanese media, and everyone laughed at how stupid these Pan-Asianists were. But by 1943, the Japanese government were themselves hosting a Pan-Asiatic conference. And so Pan-Asianism went from being, you know, like a movement that people laughed at and joked about to being governmental policy between 1926 and 1943, you could say, that something revolutionary happened in Japan. And basically it was to do with different naval treaties that were written, that were struck, and the attempts by Western powers to subordinate Japan and say, you can only develop five naval vessels for every 10 that we develop, or every 7 that we develop an attempt. Yeah. And so those who thought they could, you know, get a seat at the table of imperialism were disabused of their misconceptions slowly by the West, by the actions of the West.
Yeah.
And the Pan-Asianists came to the fore. And of course, 1917 did change a great deal, because in 1917, you know, Russia, who had been pushed back by Japan, from who had been forced to recede from Asia, they changed revolutionarily, and they had this new Bolshevik regime. And, you know, slowly Western powers began to recognize the Soviet Union. Stalin began to be referred to as Premier Stalin. And so you saw this nexus emerge of the West and the Soviet Union, which was obviously very threatening to Japan. Japan, you know, they had an emperor, they had their own Shinto religion, which they fused with the universe. So they sort of had the particularist religion of Shinto, which they fused with the universalist religion of Buddhism. They were definitely not conducive to communism. And very interestingly, too, they began to link up with pan-Islamists, because the Islamic world also had an aversion toward communism. And so this is a whole aspect that's also unknown, that, you know, as Japan went through Asia and began to liberate Asia, many anti-colonial leaders worked with Japan, many of whom were Muslim. Most prominently, Indonesia was liberated from Dutch imperial control, basically by Japan, working with Sukarno. You know, many people think of Sukarno favorably. Well, I was watching a Japanese TV show recently, and there was an old lady on there. It was a comedy show, and she was Sukarno's ex-wife. And, you know, the many anti-colonial movements viewed Japan as a liberator and were thankful for Japan beginning to use its developed status to help liberate the colonies of Asia. And Indonesia is the world's biggest Muslim country, actually. And as such, Japan, you know, it was expedient for them to sort of embrace Islam. And Shume Okawa, who I just mentioned, you know how today, like the CIA and the Mossad, they use Muslims in a very hypocritical way. There's no real sincerity when the US, sort of the CIA, sponsors Islamic groups other than to try and create carnage in different regions of the world.
Yeah.
But in the case of Japan, there was a lot more sincerity to it, because Okawa Shume translated one of the first copies of the Quran into Japanese. He wrote a book on Islam, and they viewed Islam as a potential unifying variable. And actually, in Indonesia, the Japanese set up a group called Hezbollah as World War II was coming to a close in 1945. So when all these imperial powers came back to try and retake their colonies that Japan had liberated, that there were indigenous resistance movements. And so if you go to Indonesia, and if you go to India, and if you go to many countries, you know, Japan's often looked upon favorably in that era as having basically abolished Western imperialism. And so there were the Muslims and the Japanese Pan-Asianists had a shared aversion to communism. And then we get into this whole dimension of how the FDR administration was infiltrated by people who were partisan to the Soviet Union, seemingly for ethnic reasons. You know, obviously the Soviet Union was highly philo-Semitic. Much of the Bolshevik regime was Jewish. And if you got caught, for example, with a heretical document like the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion in the Soviet Union, you were shot on the spot. And as such, that favorably disposed many Jews in Britain and France and America and elsewhere to the Soviet Union. And it's now been exposed with the release of the Venona files and with works that have been written in particular about Harry Dexter White, that the FDR administration was infiltrated by people who were operatives of the Soviet Union. And this is the weird thing, as I intimated earlier, that you know, when we think of the U.S. in Cold War terms, we think of it being a behemoth or a beacon of anti-communism as being vehemently anti-communist. But in the 1930s and 1940s, that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. was in bed metaphorically, just as JFK would be later literally with the Soviet Union. So that created an odd scenario whereby the U.S., which was ostensibly capitalist, and Japan just sort of assumed, well, the U.S. will be with us, right? They're anti-communist, ended up working with the communists. And people like Harry Dexter White, they, you know, ensconced in the U.S. Treasury, they authored a whole series of provocations against Japan, which induced Pearl Harbor. Just as they're doing with Iran today, and as I say, there's parallels in this regard, because many of the stigmatization methods and aggressive methods that were honed in this epoch have been reutilized by the neocons contemporarily to objectify and to ostracize Iran. So there was an economic blockade imposed upon Japan. There were asset freezes imposed upon Japan. And nearly all of these provocations, which pushed Japan's back against the wall, were authored by people like Harry Dexter White. And he worked in the U.S. Treasury with Henry Morgenthaler, another Jewish man who was, of course, the originator of the notorious Morgenthaler plan.
Yeah, and it's by the way, it's out of that environment, of course, where you had the Bretton Woods conference and later leads to the IMF and the World Bank and things like this. And people have no idea today the nature of their true allegiances, these people.
Yes, Harry Dexter White was pivotal in the Bretton Woods agreements. Much of your listenership may have heard of the McCollum memo that also emerged out of this milieu, which was a series of desirable goals of the U.S. government that were listed. And one of them was that if Japan can be caused to attack us first, that would be desirable. And so 86% of the U.S. public were isolationist and anti-war. The so-called enemy of America wasn't really the enemy, because actually the Pan-Asianists, they wanted to focus on Asia. And Okawa Shume, the leading ideologue of Pan-Asianism, he worked tirelessly to try and get those Yankees who like to make a buck to invest in Manchukuo, because Japan had helped Manchuria declare independence. Manchuria, of course, from the 1640s to 1912, when Sun Yat-sen had his revolution in 1912, China had been ruled by the Manchus. And so Manchuria was never actually part of China. It was always bifurcated off and was independent from China proper. And so Japan reinstated the status quo ante. They put Puyi in power and helped the Manchu people declare independence and establish Manchukuo. And what the Pan-Asianists wanted to do, they said, let's encourage America to invest in the areas we control in Asia, and then they won't want to do war with us. And it's very interesting, you know, like when you get into the Pearl Harbor stuff, many people are aware of the kind of what you might call LIHOP, let it happen on purpose, interpretation of Pearl Harbor. But when you actually look at who pioneered the attack on Pearl Harbor, it was this individual, Isoroku Yamamoto. And he had studied at Harvard. He'd worked in Washington. He was pro-American. He was Western-oriented. He was almost being assassinated in Japan by the Pan-Asianists. And so you had the Pan-Asianists were saying, the worst thing we could do is end up having a war in the Pacific while we have all this strife, on mainland Asia. And out of nowhere, Isoroku Yamamoto, who came from this pro-Western faction, you know, the antithesis of the Pan-Asianists, he pioneered the attack on Pearl Harbor. And he also lost the Battle of Midway for the for Japan. And then FDR personally got him taken out towards the end of the war. FDR ordered personally for him to be assassinated. So no one's ever developed a MIHOP theory. off Pearl Harbor. But I do implore listeners to look into Isoroku Yamamoto a little further, because I do find many of his biographical details quite suspicious in this regard. So as you can tell, you know, there's many, many sort of strands and many subtopics within this field of World War II revisionism in Asia. You know, for example, the linkage between the Pan-Asianists and the Pan-Islamists. You can imagine you could write endless PhD theses on such a topic. But I think it provides a nice entree into the field of World War II revisionism. Because, of course, to suddenly just jump straight into the sacrosanct Holocaust and jump into the German dimension and the National Socialist aspect of World War II and try to revisionistically interpret those subjects is highly taboo. And so I think what's useful with the Japanese side is it's a lot less controversial, and yet the victor's history of World War II is false. And, you know, I mentioned the Tokyo trials. Much of your listenership will be stunned, I'm sure, to hear that at the Tokyo trials, there was a judge named Justice Radhabinod Pal, and he found all the Japanese defendants not guilty. And he wrote like a 2,000-page dissentient verdict. And, you know, so the Tokyo trials were convened after Douglas MacArthur announced the Tokyo Charter, or the Charter of the Military Tribunal for the Far East. And that contained the same tenet as the Nuremberg Charter. Article 19 of the Nuremberg Charter said that this tribunal shall not be bound by the technical rules of evidence. And of course, now in France, under the Orwellian Gaisseau Act, who question the victor's history as proffered at the Nuremberg Tribunal can be and are thrown in jail for questioning the findings of the Nuremberg Tribunal.
Yep.
And that was copied and pasted into Article 13 of the Tokyo Trials Charter, which said that this tribunal shall not be bound by the technical rules of evidence. And so at the last minute, an Indian judge and a Filipino judge were appointed to the bench. And the victors of World War II, I know for sure, came to regret that, because Justice Radhabinod Pal came to the trial, and he was an Indian man, a subject of British India. And he began studying international law as it applied to the tribunal. And he began to question both the legal basis and the factual basis for the tribunal. And so it's really interesting when you get into the work of Justice Radhabinod Pal, because his dissentient verdict was not only not read out, it was not allowed to be read out at the Tokyo trials. So they stopped it being read out. And also it was illegal to disseminate it in Japan under the US occupation. And even after the US occupation ended, it was still illegal to talk about or to disseminate the Justice Radhabinod Pal's dissentient verdict. And so he drew attention to the fact that the U.S. at the Tokyo trials was attempting to apply, or the victors were attempting to apply, ex post facto law. So whether we like it or not, crimes against humanity, the war crimes and aggressive warfare were not actually crimes under international law in that period. And so what happened is that he said that while that it may be legitimate under law to convene an international tribunal of jurists, it's not legitimate for that tribunal to then legislate and then condemn people based on the legislation that they've just invented retroactively. And so he questioned the legal basis of the tribunal. He said that there was no international laws against engaging in war. And then he said, well, you know, it's a bit complex, isn't it? Because Japan's going to Asia, but like the British were already meddling in Asia. The Americans were already funneling arms to Chiang Kai-shek. The Dutch had colonies in Asia. And then the Soviet Union was beginning to expand and sponsor communist zealots in Asia too. So, you know, was Japan engaging in self-defense, which was completely legal under international law? So he delegitimized the legal foundation of the tribunal. And he also questioned many of the factual or allegedly factual claims of the prosecution. So what they attempted to say was that every single killing in Asia that occurred due to the Japanese forces or at the hands of Japanese forces, that was the product of a conspiracy. And what's really fascinating about the Tokyo trials is two of the main issues that it became fixated on were whether or not the Mukden incident of September 1932 was a false flag or not. So the issue of false flag terrorism became central in the tribunal. And additionally, what is a conspiracy? And Justice Radhabinod Pal drew attention to the fact that actually the notion of a conspiracy being a crime was something that was unique to Anglo-American jurisprudence. And that, you know, conspiracy, like the idea of like, if you and I say, let's rob a bank next week, And then we change our minds and don't rob the bank. Well, we didn't rob the bank, so we didn't commit a crime, right?
Right.
And so the idea of talking about committing a crime being justiciable was questioned also. And so that was sort of the premise of the Tokyo trials, whereby the Japanese leadership, it was said, like this handful of Japanese leaders and Shumei Okawa, the intellectual, they were part of a conspiracy to take over the world. And of course, during the war, there were many fraudulent documents disseminated by Western powers and by the communists in particular, such as the infamous Tanaka Memorandum. If people look up the Tanaka Memorandum, this was a manifesto allegedly written by a Japanese leader to take over the world. And so there was this idea that Japan wanted to take over the world, when in reality, Japan never installed itself in power when it liberated different countries in Asia. They always allowed the indigenous peoples to rule there. All they basically wanted to do was to stabilize Asia so Japan could not feel threatened perennially.
Right.
And additionally, they realized, look, we're a developed country and we have no resources. You have these agrarian societies that have rice and they have oil and they have coal. And so we can export our manufactured products to those areas of Asia. And in return, they can reciprocate by funneling their primary resources into our industrial machine. And so the Pan-Asianists, they proposed the construction of what was called the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. And so that was going to be like an organic version of the European Union rather than an authoritarian, inorganic entity like the European Union is.
Yeah.
So the people of Asia could inoculate themselves from the West by not being dependent on the mother country. Because, of course, under mercantilism, the idea was like Britain would take all these primary resources from India and that the manufacturing would take place in the mother country, in Britain, in the cotton mills of Manchester and so on.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to end that and to create dependency between Asian nations so they could develop and engage in self-determination in an organic way. As I say, there's many sort of interwoven themes to this. It's very interesting when you look at the ideology of Pan-Asianism because I think today many people are aware that, you know, Iran is attempting to unify people in their region to try and inoculate the Middle East from Western powers. So I think a study of Pan-Asianism can be useful in that regard. I also think it is axiomatic that the war on terror has been about the Zionists attempting to pit whites and Christians against Persians, Arabs, Muslims, and that therefore the logical antidote to that is a white Muslim alliance rather than, you know, many sort of members of the new right and white nationalists. They often just make gratuitous remarks on blogs about Muslims and stigmatize the Muslim community. I think it's more potent if we try to establish a Christian-Muslim alliance for the Crescent and the Cross to come together in opposition to our shared oppressor in the modern context.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, I think studying the Pan-Asianist attempts to link Japan and link Asia up with the Muslim world can offer us valuable insights. And, this Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere that was proposed, this was perhaps going to extend all the way to the Near East and into the Middle East. And so you can imagine that, you know, the Zionists who were plotting the establishment of Palestine in 1948, well, they would have also viewed, you know, apart from the fact that the Japanese were against communism and communism was the best show in town for the Jewish community in that epoch, they were also anti-Zionist, the Pan-Asianists, and supported the self-determination of Arab and Muslim peoples. And so you can imagine that, in other words, the Japanese created a lot of enemies in that era for their principled stances that they were taking. And then we can get into the whole National Socialist connection too, if you like.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating here, the backdrop, the complexity to it, things that we never do get to learn, and the intricacies of why things occurred in the way they did. Before we move on, I just want to ask you a little bit more about Pearl Harbor, if you have a different view on that today. I've heard, I haven't looked into too much in detail myself, actually, but I've heard for many years, of course, that this was a false flag. Allegedly, the codes, whatever you want to call it, were broken. They knew that something was about to happen. It was one of these, as you said, kind of let it happen events. Is there anything that you view differently today when you've looked at that? You mentioned the key person, of course, that was involved in the attack, and then that the U.S., of course, could kind of just drop their guard, allow it to happen. This drew America into the war consequently. Is there any different view you would explain on that event?
Yes. Well, as I say, you know, I have recently discovered the some biographies that have been written about Isoroku Yamamoto. So I think he's an interesting person to explore. However, I don't think I'm in a position to say I know 100% that Isoroku Yamamoto was some kind of, you know, agent of the American government who did Pearl Harbor in order to help America and to sabotage the interests of the Pan-Asianists or something like that.
Right.
I can't say that for sure, but I think that is a thesis that can be considered when we look at his sketch, when we look at the fact that the main biography written about Isoroku Yamamoto was written by a guy who used to head the U.S. Psychological Warfare Department during the war. And so it seems like there's an attempt to sort of contain the memory of Isoroku Yamamoto. But generally, what you just said seems to be correct. Yes, that the codes had been cracked. I've actually interviewed Thomas Kimmel, who's the grandson of Husband E. Kimmel, who was the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor and who was kind of scapegoated for Pearl Harbor. And he's kind of on a truth crusade to try and exonerate the name of his grandfather. And he's talked about this reality that the codes were cracked and so on. But I think the more interesting dimension is that, yes, there were all these provocations that were seemingly implemented to make Japan attack America. So the American public, 86% of whom were against war, could be persuaded to support war against Japan and war against Germany later on. But I think the most germane aspect is that the people who were authoring these provocations were agents of the Soviet Union. And it's amazing, right, isn't it? Because, you know, of course, again, this is another sort of parallel between the present and the past, that, you know, the sanctions against Iran, the provocations against Iran have mainly been authored by Zionists for sort of ethnic and ideological reasons, just as the provocations against Japan were authored by, let's be honest, Jewish individuals who were partisan for their own good reasons to the Soviet Union. And so it seems that, you know, when you hear like claims that, you know, many of the wars in recent history have had a large Zionist role in their instigation, that seems to be vindicated by the historical facts. And so, you know, it's very important, you know, a foundational claim of World War II revisionists is that the victors after the war, in order to distinguish the killings of the Axis forces from those of the Allied forces, had to construct narratives ex post facto of unprecedented mass killings, be they in Nanking or be they in relation to Auschwitz and the Holocaust and all that. So much of the revisionistic historiography focuses on those issues rather than on the origins of the war. But I think even when you go into the origins of these wars, it shows that we've also been provided with a false teleology and a false historiography. For example, Veronica Clark, you mentioned, has focused on the Gleiwitz incident, the alleged false flag of the Germans, which allowed them to invade Poland. And her next book is going to be on the Gleiwitz incident and the false flag that Germany was accused of having done. And she's going to be debunking that. And it's the same thing with this. It's the same thing with this Manchurian incident, or the Mukden incident, as it's often called, where Japan was accused of doing a false flag in order to help to implement the independence of Manchukuo. But when you actually look into the evidence of Japan having done a false flag, it's really quite weak. And I'm thinking of going to write something, you know, maybe to mirror what Veronica has done with the Gleiwitz incident. And she's asked me to write an introduction to her book on the Gleiwitz incident. I'm thinking of writing something on this Mukden incident. And one of the best sources to show the weakness of the allegation that a false flag was done in Mukden. So the claim was that the Japanese blew up a railway track, because basically in Manchuria, Japan only had the right to be for something like 12 miles to either side of this railway that went through Manchuria in order to protect their interests. They weren't allowed to be engaging in military operations throughout Manchuria. And so the claim was that the Japanese blew up their own railway track in order to justify going into the town of Mukden and expanding throughout Manchuria on operations. But the Japanese said actually that, look, there's all these Chinese warlords, all these factions, and it was a Chinese person who let off a bomb in the vicinity of the railway track. They didn't actually blow up the railway track because a train passed over it like 10 minutes later. And so this is interesting because the UN actually, not the UN, sorry, the League of Nations actually deployed commissioners to go and investigate that at the request of the Chinese government. And they published the Lytton report. And it's quite significant in the history of the League of Nations because Japan withdrew from the League of Nations based on the findings of this Litton report into the strife in Manchuria. But even the Litton report said that they didn't find convincing evidence that that was a false flag. So you have the findings of the Litton report and you have Justice Radhabinod Pal's refutation of the allegations of the Manchurian incident or Mukden incident having been a false flag. And so whether it's Pearl Harbor or whether it's the Manchurian incident or in the context of Europe, the Gliwice incident, it seems that the origins of these wars have been interpreted in a fraudulent manner. And moreover, the memory of these wars or the memory of the killings that took place during those wars has also been embellished in order to distinguish the killings of the Axis forces from those of the Allied forces. And one of the issues that's focused upon by Japanese historical revisionists is the alleged Nanking Massacre. And in a couple of interviews I've done recently, I've actually turned to page 26 of my book, Japan Bites Back. And if you'll allow me, I'll just read an interesting paragraph to you.
Sure, so go ahead. Yeah.
Hear it from the horse's mouth, as it were. I wrote, "It was highly stimulating and somewhat amusing observing the hysterical response to the 2014 book, Falsehoods of the Allied Nations' Victorious View of History, as seen by a British journalist, authored by the former Tokyo bureau chief of The Times, The New York Times, and The Financial Times, Henry Stokes, in which he questions the notion that a massacre took place in Nanking in 1937-38. The English language Japanese media initially falsely claimed that he had recanted his controversial statements. In other words, they resorted to disinformation, which compelled Stokes and his publisher to reaffirm that the author's opinion is the so-called Nanking massacre never took place. The word massacre is not right to indicate what happened." And that quote is coming from the former bureau chief of The Times, The New York Times, and The Financial Times. And so an interesting phenomenon which I've identified, if you read the Japanese media and the English language Japanese media, is journalists, often with Jewish names, on a seemingly daily basis bombarding the Japanese public and the Japanese political class with demands of the desperate need for hate speech laws and for anti-revisionist laws in Japan. Because as I said earlier, Tokyo and Tehran seem to be the only two places in the world right now where you can question the victor's history of World War II without being thrown into a dungeon by the state. And actually, you may have heard of the Yasukuni Shrine, which is controversial because those Japanese soldiers who fought to liberate Asia in World War II, their names have been enshrined at the Yasukuni Shrine. And you'll note that many Japanese prime ministers and many Japanese politicians visit the Yasukuni Shrine, and the Western media and the Zionists create sort of hysteria when that happens.
Right.
I went there in September, and adjacent to the Yasukuni Shrine is the Yushukan. And the Yushukan is a museum, a very well-funded, very nicely done museum, which presents the revisionistic take of World War II. And so not only do you have revisionists in the Japanese parliament questioning the victor's history of World War II, not only do you have many mainstream professors at prominent universities in Japan questioning the victor's history of World War II, you actually have a very nicely done museum in central Tokyo, which provides that interpretation. And you can imagine if you tried to create such a museum in Berlin, providing the National Socialist critique of Weimar Germany and then a defense of the National Socialist actions in the era, that its curators would be burnt at the stake to metaphorize and thrown into a dungeon to be literal. And so that's a big difference, right? And you can see how the Zionists are sort of panicked by that. They realize that if historical revisionism is mainstream and allowed to happen, and if unfettered freedom of speech is allowed to continue in Japan, that French people and German people and people in other countries in the West will say, look at Japan. Why are they allowed to question the victor's history of World War II? Why are they allowed to talk about this in a free public debate? But we are not.
Yeah.
And so it's the threat of a good example, which is why the Zionists are working tirelessly to have thought crime laws enacted in that country. And you can see sort of Japanese literati bemused as to why it is the case that 7 decades after the war, it should be heretical and heterodox to question the victor's history and to question the propagandistic claims that were made about Japan in that era. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, we're in 1945, we've just vanquished your country, and these sets of myths about Japan have to be sacrosanct because we've just, you know, we're America and we've just come into your country. But seven decades hence, to say you can't question those propagandistic claims, even though many of them are not defensible and have no evidence to support them, bemuses Japanese intelligentsia. And so it's hard for them to understand, perhaps, because they may not understand the influence of Zionists in the West and the reality that hate speech laws and the criminalization of revisionism was basically something plotted and schemed for by the organized Jewish community, because it seems to be in the interest of the nation state of Israel, or the Zionist entity, as it should be called, to have certain elements of the victor's history of World War II made to be sacrosanct and to make discussions about that historiography a matter for the judiciary rather than a matter for the professors and for the intellectuals to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's quite a stark difference. And again, that's why I think this whole field of World War II revisionism in relation to Japan has a certain subversive quality to it, because it's quite easy to debunk what they've claimed about Japan. And if it is the case that the official history of World War II in Asia is fraudulent and false, then the next question, of course, is what is true and what is not true vis-a-vis Germany. And I saw that. I think it can be very useful in that regard, too.
Absolutely fascinating. It's just, there's just so many, points here and issues that I want to discuss more with you here a little bit later here. I want to, of course, ask you more about Iran, also, of course, the Muslim-Christian or Western alliance, as you suggested. I think that's a very important point. And then later we can move on to talk more about the pressure, or where the pressure is now when it comes to Japan, as there, I've seen indications that they are seeking to transform that country, especially when it comes to their homogeneity and things like that. But we'll talk more about that later. I wanted to ask you more about the basis of the alignment between Germany and the National Socialists then, and Japan, if there's any other details there that you think are vital to discuss. I mean, we talked about the threat of communism at some point. I'm not familiar with the nature of the alignment and what the agreements were and all the intricacies of that, but maybe we can talk about the bigger picture there, and if there's anything else to that that you think is important to mention.
Yes, there was the Three Power Pact, and the which Japan later acceded to. I have an essay in my book which I transcribed on the Three Power Pact, rather, on page 216, that begins, written by Nobumasa Suretsugu. And he explains why Japan embraced that. And basically, it was due to their shared aversion to communism. There was a perception that Germany was one of the leading bulwarks of anti-communism in Europe, and that Japan was the leading bulwark of anti-communism in Asia, and that the Americans and the British were sort of in bed with the communists, and therefore it made sense essentially for Japan to fall into the German camp. But even at a deeper level, you know, within Japan, as I mentioned, there were many schools of thought and many different political factions. And so you had those who had like studied Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence and Anglo-Saxon philosophy, but there were many people, many bureaucrats in Japan and many intellectuals who were sort of Germanicists. They were experts on German jurisprudence and German ideology. So there was actually some depth to that, you know, the Japanese-German alliance. Mm-hmm. There was also interesting, like, I mentioned the Russo-Japanese War in 1904, 1905. And many people will have heard of Jacob Schiff, the Jewish banker who basically swayed that war by providing Japan with unended loans or unlimited loans so they could afford to fight that war and vanquish Russia. But the inadvertent consequence was that the Japanese came to view individual Jewish businessmen as sort of having power to change the history of the world and having the power to sway wars and so on. And so they set up a department to deal with the Jewish question. They actually called it the Fugu Plan that they formulated. Fugu is blowfish. If you don't prepare blowfish properly, it poisons you to death, right?
Yeah.
So they made this Fugu Plan. And actually, that was another reason, I think, why they probably ostracized the Zionists or alienated the Zionists, was they were actually wanting to adopt a policy of containment. So it seems that throughout history, when nations have clashed with the Jews, they've adopted two types of policies. One is exclusion and expulsion. The other is what you might call containment. And I think you've seen this in the Muslim world, where Jews live within the polity, but they perhaps don't have the equal political rights and so on. And I think the Japanese were attempting to do that. They wanted to encourage the Zionists to come to Manchuria and set up kibbutzes based on the idea that, you know, you keep your friends close, but your enemies are even closer. And so they were also, I think, aware of the traits or the policies of the Jewish community. And therefore, they may have seen an alliance with Germany based on that. But I think I think that generally there was this idea that, well, imagine we could do an east-west attack on Germany, like Germany attacks Russia or the Soviet Union from the east, and we attack from the west, and we could remove this this behemoth, this expansionist behemoth as a threat to both of our nations. So again, Isoroku Yamamoto, the guy who pioneered the Pearl Harbor attack, interestingly went berserk when Japan signed the tripartite pact and agreed to cement itself on the side of Germany in an alliance against communism. So they agreed to basically, it was sort of like a mutual defense pact, I think, like people, that if the Soviet Union attacked Germany, that would be viewed as an attack on Japan and Italy too, and vice versa. And so it's interesting, isn't it? Because when you look in the post-World War II, and when you look at the post-World War II realities that communism came to Asia and killed as many as 65 million people. I mean, in the modern context, many of us have a certain amount of sympathy with North Korea and with China because they're sort of stigmatized by the West. But they're not organic ideologies for the people of Asia. Communism is not an organic ideology. And the pan-Confucianist, pan-Buddhist dispensation that was adopted and promoted by the Pan-Asianists was organic for the people of Asia.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so revisionists today that in Japan, they say, well, look, the Japanese discourse of the time was basically vindicated. They said that if we don't go to Asia and create this greater East Asia pro-prosperity sphere and inoculate Asia from the Western imperialism and communist expansionism, then the future of Asia will be the capitalist European countries and the communist countries tearing Asia to shreds. And
exactly.
When you look at the Mao Zedong, working as he was as a surrogate of the Soviet Union, came to power in China, although there would later be a Sino-Soviet split. But still, at that time, the communists came to power and 65 million people died in China as a result of that. You had the Indonesian Civil War. Would the Vietnam War have happened had Japan won World War II in Asia?
Right.
I don't think so, right?
Yeah.
Because Japan was working heavily with indigenous leaders in the Siam, which was, I guess, Thailand, and in Vietnam and in Indochina generally. So the Japanese revisionists say basically what we said was right, and we've been vindicated. That, you know, the Korean War happened straight after World War II, where you saw the U.S. and the communists tearing the Korean Peninsula to shreds. Obviously that's what the Tripartite Pact existed to prevent, was communism coming to Asia.
Well, you know, people, an excuse to term, but they get their panties in a wad here, because especially today, with the view that we have today, because, you know, at the time, Germany and Japan and other countries as well that aligned themselves to the Axis forces, they were firm. They were very strong. They were, you know, they're, of course, fascist ideologies, all this kind of stuff we're hearing, right? But it's like, yeah, if you're going to go up in a fight against Mike Tyson, you're not going to win by pleading to his kindness, being well-intended or limp-wristed. Of course, the opposition would have loved if, you know, they just rolled over and gave up before they even began. I think they understood their enemy in a way that we don't understand them today, because we are living in their reconstruction of the world. Most people today don't appreciate that the people opposing the world that we live in today were trying to do something against their enemy, their mortal enemy. And if they would have got their hands on the world as they did, Communist International, hello, that's what they call it, Communist International, they did get their hands on the world. And of course, this is what they accuse the opposition of wanting to do, conquer the world. This is always what they do, projection, they reverse it. But I think that this is about the fact that they understood the problem at the time and they realized that they had to deal with it. And I think all things considered and all things that we can now review historically, I think the reply, the response that was offered here is perfectly understandable at the time. It's tremendously unfortunate, absolutely. Look at how many people died, how many Europeans died for this infection, for this virus of an ideology of communism. And I'm not saying that war is a good thing. However, thank God that someone tried at least to do something against this, standing up to it, not just roll over and give up, giving up before we even began. At least they tried to fight, and it's indicative of a spirit within humanity which refuses to give in to this kind of absolute tyranny. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough, though. The rest of the world, infected with this virus, turned against the very countries that were attempting to cut out this cancer, this viral communist strain that had so much blood on its hands, so many millions of bodies on their hands already. It destroyed so many ancient, beautiful cultures. I mean, the people, I think, around at the time could see this. And we live in a world where communism won. This fake Cold War facade, you know, this false dichotomy of so-called American capitalism and Soviet communism. I hope that most are able to see through this as a kind of a, you know, false opposition, if you will. But, you know, much of the evidence for all of this hardly goes, you know, discussed. It goes largely unnoticed in our world today. It's not discussed at all, from the Holodomor to the gulags and the slaughter of countless of Russians. I mean, how many movies, for example, do we see about this? In fact, their role is even praised by countless people. Even Stephen Harper now recently, the Canadian Prime Minister, praised the communists' role in World War II for helping to defeat the enemy and for saving the world. You know, thank you, Bolshevism, for your good work. You know, estimates as high as, 20 to 40 million, maybe even more bodies and counting. You know, no problem. Job well done. And isn't he supposed to be a right-wing conservative? I think it speaks volumes about where his allegiances really lie, and that this indeed is a fake dichotomy. And this is what we live in today. No real options. You know, do you want communism light or communism ultra, extra menthol? You know, it's so. Anyway, it angers me that so few people recognize this destruction of this opposition, this murderous ideology that they were faced with at the time, and that people can't really see all the trees for the forest because they're raised in this environment that the victors have created, which really is an enemy of mankind, you know. And today it's not about taking, you know, the sides of this or the other. It's about recognizing the crimes of those who did what they did in order to take control of the world. I mean, look around and ask yourself, do you like what you see around you, or do you think that something is wrong in the world today? What do you think, Joshua?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there's definitely a bias where, you know, Hollywood has emphasized the real and imagined killings of the Axis forces in World War II. And yet the misdeeds of the Soviet Union, for example, have tended to be underemphasized. And I think that that obviously has to do with the reality that much of the Bolshevik leadership were Jews. And even you see, like, in the Israeli media, I think it was Ynet, the Israeli news outlet, had an article entitled Some of the Worst Killers in History Have Been Jews, and they emphasized the killings in Ukraine and the genocide in Ukraine, which seemed to have had a sort of ethnic dimension to it.
Yeah. The Holodomor.
The Holodomor, yeah. And so that gets underemphasized. And so that, you know, obviously that's a big dimension of this, that, you know, you sort of condemn everything Japan did, but you don't situate it in the context of what arose after Japan was forced to recede from Asia, which was, you know, like 65 million people. Did Japan kill 65 million people in China? I don't think so, right?
Yeah.
And this was one of the things, like Ralph Townsend, why his writings are particularly germane. He noted that basically after Sun Yat-sen had his revolution in China in 1912, that China degenerated into warlordism and civil war. And that actually the most stable territories in the whole region were those controlled by Japan, and that even Chinese people were flocking to the territories controlled by Japan because there was the rule of law there, they could get a job because Japan was helping to industrialize those regions. And so, you know, these warlords would get brought on speaking tours to America and were put in suits, you know, besuited warlords were taken to campuses and they would talk about democracy and how China, you know, they were like Chiang Kai-shek's forces, for example, were Republicans trying to bring democracy to Asia. And yet in reality, those people would go back to China and continue, you know, fighting against their fellow Chinamen. And it's even more interesting when you get into like who was advising Chiang Kai-shek, because you had like Zionists not only advising the communists on the ground in China, you also had Zionists working with Chiang Kai-shek too. And I actually have a segment on that in my book, which is really, really quite fascinating too. I'm not sure if I can find the page here, but yeah. So there was obviously this attempt to by Western powers and by the Zionists to never allow the people of Africa, the people of Asia, and the people of the quote-unquote non-white world, or those countries outside the West, to control their own societies. And Japan, in its discourse in the era, often emphasized the truism that the Americans had declared the Monroe Doctrine in their orbit and had said that, you know, we are not going to allow any foreign power to come into the American hemisphere unchecked. And yet in Asia, they promoted and demanded the open door policy in China, whereby all the powers of the world could descend upon China and have spheres of influence in China. And so often the Japanese referred to a sort of Japanese Monroe Doctrine, whereby just as Japan, as the most developed nation in Asia, would inoculate Asia from foreign influence, just as America said, well, we're the most powerful country in the Americas, and therefore we have a kind of role to assume of preventing intervention in the Americas. And yet that's not what the West wanted. And so, yep, they were funneling arms to Chiang Kai-shek, and the Soviets were funneling arms to Mao Zedong's communists. And mm-hmm. there were loads of other warlord factions there on the ground in China who were being sponsored. And Japan said, you know, if we just sit back, China's eventually going to, you know, it's sort of like what they're doing with the Odeji-Nompan plan in the Middle East today, where they're sponsoring terrorists and sponsoring zealots and sponsoring warlords. So all of Israel's enemies will be quarreling amongst themselves, and then Israel can rely upon having a hegemony in the region and longevity in power in that region. And so it's the same in China, whereby the different warlords and different terrorist factions were sponsored, so China would sort of devour itself and would self-destruct, and then America and the Soviet Union and the other powers could control that country and control the region. Mm-hmm. And Japan had a different vision, and it emerged as a regional hegemon, as I said. And that's why they were targeted, because they challenged Western Zionist hegemony in that region.
Right, right. Well, this is just absolutely fascinating, Yasha. There's so many things here that we've never heard before. A side of the store of this of the history of the times here that we, you know, never hear about in any capacity at all, and the intricacies and the very the small detailed battles that was going on. It's just absolutely fascinating. And I have so much more I want to ask you about. Feels like we're just kind of scratching the surface here, but let's do that in the second segment. We can take a short break here, but before we do that, of course, I want you to mention where people can go to pick up a copy of the book. The title here again, of course, Japan Bites Back, Documents Contextualizing Pearl Harbor. And share with us your websites as well, so people can follow your work more closely, Joshua.
Yes, so Brandon Martinez and I, we founded nonalignedmedia.com. That's nonalignedmedia.com. And I do have a picture of my book on there. And if you click that, that takes you to the Amazon link. Or you can just go on Amazon and type in Japan Bites Back, or type in my name, Joshua Blakeney. The book's available as a Kindle ebook or as a softcover book. And it can be ordered in Europe and anywhere in the world, in Canada, in the US. It's also available from CreateSpace. So people could also go to, I think it's createspace.com, and order the book through there. If you go to Non-Aligned Media, we also have a link to Non-Aligned Media Books, where you can see the books published by my colleague, Brandon Martinez. He's recently, actually just in the last couple of weeks, put out a book on the ISIS conspiracy, which people might also find interesting. And they can see an advertisement for my book there too.
All right, very good. We're going to have the links up to the website here, nonalignedmedia.com. And I think you have your own joshuablakeney.info as well, or something like that, I believe.
Yeah, I've sort of let that lapse a little bit. I haven't been updating that as regularly. But if you just want like a basic biographical sketch and a few links to my I have a YouTube channel. My YouTube channel is Globalization 1492. All one word. So Globalization 1492. And that's my YouTube channel. And people can see my Press TV reports and Press TV interviews on there, as well as my own radio show, which I host, is posted on that YouTube channel too.
All right. Very good. We're going to have the links up. Fascinating stuff. We'll return here shortly and talk more with Joshua Blakeney. Stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Joshua. We'll be right back. In the member segment, we weigh up the magnitude of the history of nuclear weapons used to annihilate Japan by the US in sick demonstrations of power over the East. Joshua speaks to many of the historical narratives that are not allowed to be questioned, and we look at the corrosion of civil liberties throughout the West accomplished by government rule that does not hold the best interest of the citizens at heart. Later, Joshua illustrates Japan's homogeneous, tight-knit culture that strongly rejects New World Order policies and multiculturalism. We discuss the need for a third position to view the imported problems created by mass immigration, along with the necessity for Muslims, immigrants, and whites to avoid serving Zionist interests. At the end, Joshua describes how Japan's connection to the land and the collective spirituality has allowed the country to develop a superior culture, if you compare it with many others today. You can sign up and tune in at redicemembers.com. We spare you from commercial interruptions, and we have a ton of interesting shows for you in our archives. If you like what we do, do get a hold of a subscription. It's well worth it. Only €5 per month. And by the way, the dollar is almost equal with the euro right now as well. So it will serve you good to jump on the opportunity now when the dollar is much stronger as well. You can sign up for a 3-month subscription, recurring or non-recurring, and we have other options going all the way up to 2 years, whatever works for you. Before we proceed here, I just want to let you know about some of our upcoming guests. Vasily Lupash on the true story of Vlad Tepes, or Dracula, very interesting show. We have Alexander Dugin, Marion Van Court, E. Michael Jones, and Dr. Mercola as well. But we'll be back with another second hour with Joshua Blakeney. Stay with us. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you after the break.